talking behind the news. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two interviews lined up for today. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Tom Athanasiou, who is the director of EcoEquity, a little think tank based in the Bay Area on issues of climate change. We'll talk to him about where the politics of climate change are after the Copenhagen summit, and what next, and can we save life on Earth, or is everything just all hopeless? I hope Tom will cheer us up. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Steffi Woolhandler, one of the founders of Physicians for a National Health Program, about that monstrosity that just passed in Washington, D.C. What's in it? What does it mean? What does it do? What doesn't it do? What should it do? What won't it do? Etc. Steffi Woolhandler. Okay, before all that, just a few words on the economic news. Not much in the way of economic news since last we spoke. The U.S. economy continues to flatline, which only looks good compared to the collapse of 2008 and 2009. The Chicago branch of the Federal Reserve puts out a monthly national activity index, a composite of 85 separate indicators. That's a good single measure of the state of the economy. It's as good a measure of the state economy that we have. When it's above zero, the economy is expanding at its historical average. Below zero, it's growing below trend. And when it's at zero, it's at trend. It broke above zero, barely, in January, but fell back below in February. The thing is volatile, so it's best to average it out over a few months. Such averaging is telling us that while the economy is picking up some, it's still pretty feeble. The February decline was driven by weakness in the housing market and a slowdown in the factory sector. Some of that manufacturing weakness may have been the result of the bad snowstorms last month. But it's also the case that the economy, to move from abstraction to personification, is so punch drunk that it needs to lie on the floor for a little while until the room stops spinning. The housing market, of course, a major culprit in the economic mess we're in, just can't get up either. Sales of existing houses fell slightly in February, the third consecutive decline. The previous two were much bigger. This was pretty small. That brought the sales pace back to where it was last June. That suggests that with the recovery we saw in the second half of the year, a nearly a 30% rise in housing sales, now largely reversed, that looks more and more like the result of the special tax credit granted to first-time housebuyers, and not what Wall Street likes to call organic growth. Sales of new houses, a much smaller market than already existing ones, fell for the fourth consecutive month in February to an all-time low in 47 years of data. And over that period, the population has grown by about 40%, so that's a remarkable thing to set a new low. Setting five-decade record lows is not what an economic recovery is supposed to look like. Here, too, some analysts are blaming February's bad weather for some of the housing weakness. Maybe. March has been more lamb-like than lion-like, so we'll get a test of the weather thesis pretty soon. But my guess is that the weather depressed things a bit, but the real problem is the economy and credit markets are still pretty sick. Housing is important, not only because it was so central to both bubble and bust, but also because it's historically been the first economic sector to lead a recovery. Certainly the authorities are doing all they can to promote that recovery. Not only was there that federal credit I just mentioned, they're also doing it at the state level. California, for example, which is so broke that it's laying off 30,000 teachers, is nonetheless going to offer up to $10,000 tax credits for people who buy houses, which will cost the state $200 million. Twice as much as last year's similar program. That $200 million is the equivalent of about 4,000 teachers by my math, but goosing up the real estate business is apparently more important than teaching kids. And in an indicator I haven't cited in a while, first-time applications for unemployment insurance, a very timely and sensitive indicator of the state of the job market, fell by 14,000 last week, the third decline in 4 weeks. This measure had declined steadily for most of 2009, portending the stabilization of the labor market that we saw late last year, but had stalled out at the turn of the year. Unemployment claims are still at a pretty high level, though, which means that employment is likely to hang on just either side of unchanged for the next few months. Maybe we'll see some minor growth, but I doubt we're going to see anything major. In longer-term news, the Pew Charitable Trust, a philanthropy, ironically enough, that got its money from an oil fortune, it's just out with a report on the global state of investment in clean energy technologies. The sensational soundbite, China is taking the lead, and the U.S. is falling badly behind. Globally, Pew reports, clean energy investments fell only modestly during the recession, which is a good thing, and have since recovered nicely. But that's no thanks to the USA. China's total stock of renewable energy generation is about to surpass that of the U.S., even though our economy is far bigger. Total U.S. clean energy investment actually fell by 40% last year, though it's picking up some this year. If you rank the world's nations by clean energy investment as a share of their GDP, the U.S. comes in 11th, lagging much poorer countries like Mexico and Turkey. Compared to the leaders, the U.S. performance is shameful. 1/6 the clean energy investment share of Spain, 1/4 that of Britain, 1/3 of that of China and Brazil. And although the Obama administration has made a lot of noise about investing in clean energy and other green technologies, they're really not asking for much in their 2011 budget. And you're not likely to get what you don't ask for. Bigger numbers could stimulate the economy while saving life on Earth. But change we can believe in apparently does not extend to actual change. Maybe we should have read that slogan more carefully. Maybe it's always been more about belief than actual change. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to talk about climate change. And that's the Feelies doing a cover of Velvet Underground's White Light, White Heat. Ah, the old New Jersey scene. Now we're joined on the line by Tom Athanasiou, who is the director of EcoEquity, a little think tank based in the Bay Area, and keeper of their EcoEquity blog, author of the books Dead Heat and before that Divided Planet, and all-around climate savant. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
So, you asked me to start with a good question. Is there any hope for life on Earth?
Yes.
Okay, that's a good answer. Convince me now, Tom.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, it was a joke question, right? There's a big distinction between life on Earth and human civilization as we know it.
Right. Well, some version of human civilization as we know it.
The best way to answer that question, I think, Doug, is that it is actually scientifically plausible right now to ask the question, is the Earth's climate system already in runaway? We don't know that it is, but a case can be made. And meanwhile, the right wing is treating science, has decided that science is leftist ideology. So we have a problem.
Now, I was reading some horror story the other day about what happens if the Siberian tundra melts and releases oodles of methane into the atmosphere. We're completely finished, right?
That's correct. That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. That's what is known as a positive feedback. There's a tremendous amount of methane and also carbon bound into various deposits throughout the Earth's ecosystem, and much of it could be released. And it tends to get released as the planet warms. The easiest way to think about what we're looking about, if we're looking at as being a possibility, if you're not going to just be really anthropocentric about it and just think about things like human death and diseases and stuff like that, think about the total deglaciation of the planet. Think about all the ice melting. Right, that's the kind of picture you should have in your mind as a worst case. I mean, it's equivalent to about a 60 to 70 meter rise in sea level. It pretty much means the inundation of all coasts everywhere, all major human settlements, that are not inland.
So Iowa would be waterfront property, essentially.
Exactly, and the question you have to ask is, is human civilization as currently constituted resilient equitable and cooperative enough to make a graceful transition given that kind of a stressor?
I think the answer to that is probably no.
It's probably not.
But let's bracket that anxiety for a moment and talk about some more immediate concerns. The right, of course, who thinks science is a left-wing plot, had a lot of grist handed to them for their mill with the climate gate, the scandalous emails. What to make of all that?
Well, we've discovered that scientists are human beings, and they can get bitchy on emails that they think are private. Is this a great surprise? Especially when you're part of a community of researchers who, by and large, think yourself separate from the scrum of right-wing, left-wing politics, and you're suddenly being attacked by these organized and highly funded neo-fascist lobbies as being, conniving this leftist, this leftist plot. I mean, these people they're being battered all the time. They're being insulted all the time. These are science creeps. They bitch to each other. Is this a surprise?
Let's talk a second about this machine of denialism. Who is funding it? So we certainly see these moronic political figures around the TV pretty often. I heard a great story. I think it was a Der Spiegel reporter said to Inhofe, maybe, you're a very stupid man at a press conference. I wish we had journalists in the United States who said things like that. But who is really the machinery behind pushing this denialism around?
Well, there has been quite a bit of research done on that in the last 5 years. And, it's not entirely dissimilar from the old tobacco story. In this case, the money tends to come from large, large oil companies and coal companies. It's complicated, but by and large, I suppose you could say the fossil cartel. And that is to say the people who speak for a particular sector of capital, the sector that is bound to the fossil fuels.
The filth merchants.
Yeah. I mean, it's more complicated than that. Things that are cultural and ideological are always more complicated, but it really does come down to that. And there's really a fairly small number, an almost vanishingly small number, if you consider it to be first-tier scientists who are in any way skeptical of the fundamental thrust of climate science. There are obviously questions. There are a lot of questions having to do with the clouds. There are a lot of questions having to do with positive feedback thresholds. There are a lot of questions having to do with the ice and its behaviors, which turn out to be quite complicated. But the main line of the science is very well established, and the function of denialism by and large is to keep us from talking about what we're going to do about the situation that we're in. Rather, we'll dither and delay for another couple of decades talking about if we're in any situation at all. That's the plan.
A couple of years ago, it looked like there was at least a small, medium-sized coalition of big American companies developing that supported some kind of action on climate change. Might not be what you and I would like, but they were at least tilting in the right direction. That now seems to be fraying a bit. What's happening with that?
I don't know that it's true. I was just when you called, I was reading this email about that was just released. A Deutsche Bank study was just released that has surveyed climate and energy policies around the world and has discovered that by and large, the Europeans, and particularly the Germans and the Scandinavians, and the Chinese are working as hard as they can to dominate low-carbon technology. And there are significant sectors of American capital who know this and would like to be competitive in that very, very promising area. They're not getting a lot of press right now, but they're still around. So...
Well, GE wants
a mixed bag, right?
GE wants to sell nuclear plants, right?
Yeah, nuclear plants. There's a very interesting story about nuclear, which is that there's two fuel cycles, and there's a cleaner fuel cycle based on thorium, and it was never adopted because it didn't it didn't lend itself to weaponization, like the uranium-plutonium fuel cycle. And they preferred that one. But that's a whole other story.
I want to talk some about the politics of this. You know, we had that conference in Copenhagen. Looked like, to an amateur such as myself, looked like a bit of a failure. What's your evaluation now that a couple of months have passed? Was it a flop?
It's a very, very hard question. I mean, was it a failure relative to the emergency global mobilization that we need to launch at a planetary level? Absolutely. Was it a failure in terms of breaking the North-South impasse? Absolutely. Was it in some ways a step forward tactically? Could it possibly lead? Were there good things that happened at Copenhagen? Absolutely, there were good things that happened in Copenhagen, but it's sort of complicated and insider baseball-ish stuff. You know, the bottom line is that people were expecting or hoping for a massive structural breakthrough, and they didn't get it. And by and large, the reason they didn't get it is because the so-called Annex I countries, the industrialized Western countries, didn't put a serious offer on the table. I mean, that's the bottom line in all of this, that there has to be a reasonably fair global accord made in which we commit ourselves to a fair transition in which the countries that are responsible for climate change and the countries that are capable, that have the wealth and technology to engage the problem, step up to the plate. And until they do, it's just not going to happen.
I'm speaking with Tom Athanasiou, who is the author of Dead Heat and Divided Planet, and director of EcoEquity, a little think tank based in the Bay Area of California. Tom, a lot of people, sort of center and right-wing in the American political spectrum, want to point a finger at China. China is the big climate culprit now, and they don't want to talk so much about us. It's all a Chinese problem. How does China fit into the physics of this, but also the politics of it?
Well, this is a very, very good question. China is, of course, the big scapegoat in the United States right now, and nothing that I say should be interpreted in any way as an apologia for Chinese capitalism. But the bottom line here with respect to climate policy is that China is still a country that has a very, very large poor subpopulation, and its emissions on any reasonable metric of comparison are lower than ours, and furthermore, it appears to be doing more than us. So when you add those three things together, it's really hard to reach the conclusion that the impasse is China's fault.
Yeah, I opened this show with some remarks drawing on the Pew study that just came out showing that China is about to surpass the U.S. in its clean energy investment, and we're falling rather badly behind. So
the Chinese are absolutely committed to dominating solar, absolutely committed to dominating wind, et cetera, et cetera. And, the main line of the climate movement, this is its favorite argument. You know, if we don't start competing, they're going to eat our lunch. You can see why they want to make that argument. It's absolutely true. And there's no storyline that starts here and goes into the future that has a happy ending in which we don't have massive amounts of innovation, and it's a capitalist society, et cetera, et cetera. So that's got to be part of the story. But the rest of the story, the part that we focus on at EcoEquity, is what are the social and justice implications of the situation. And by this I mean realism. You know, how fair does the transition globally have to be to to imagine that it could succeed? That's the question that we want to ask. Obviously, there needs to be a huge amount of innovation, and obviously the Chinese are committed to that innovation, are committed to dominating that innovation, and if we don't get our act together, they're going to eat our lunch. But at the same time, we're much wealthier than them. You know, we have obligations to try to save some of the people who are not Chinese and who are not American, who are going to get inundated. Think of the Africans. The Africans are the great victims here. The warming in Africa is going to be twice on average what it is in other parts of the world, and they didn't cause this problem. So it's a mixed bag, and you have to decide what kind of argument you're going to make.
I want to return to this in just a moment, but first, what exactly is the United States doing or not doing? And the Obama administration made a lot of noise about investment in clean energy, both as a good thing for the earth and also as a good economic stimulus. From what I read of their budget, they're offering pennies for that. Am I missing anything?
No. The excuse is obvious, right, that Congress is completely dysfunctional and you can't get anything through it unless it's a very smelly kind of sausage. And, you know, the cap and dividend bill, that is the, you know, there are competing bills in Congress, and some of them are better than others. What's going to come out? Is it likely to be what we need? Is it likely to be enough?
Is it likely to be anything? I mean, are they actually going to do anything on cap and trade or anything like that?
We really don't know. I mean, it looks like the next thing down the chute is going to be finance reform, right? So are they going to be empowered by the healthcare episode or disempowered by the healthcare episode? We don't know the answer to that question. You know, from the global perspective, people are honestly talking about, is it possible to put together a global transition coalition that sets the United States aside and says that, you know, the United States is paralyzed by its internal civil war. It's going to pay the price of this paralysis because the rest of the world is going to get all of the first mover advantages associated with the clean technology transition, but we're going to have to put together a geopolitical strategy that allows the world to move forward with the United States, you know, hopefully eventually getting its act together and being able to participate. That conversation is going on. There's even people talking about trade sanctions against the United States if it refuses to participate in a serious way in a global clean energy transition.
Do other national legislatures have people like cretins like James Inhofe, or we really is this another instance of American exceptionalism?
It appears to be. I mean, there's a lot of wacky stuff that goes on in the world, but it seems to have something to do with the structure of the American government, and it seems to have something to do with the frontier mentality, and it's just a bit of a benighted country. I mean, I don't want to come off as not loving the United States of America, of which I am. I do, though, often describe myself as a Californian, but you know, it appears to be worse here. You know, not that Canada's great shakes or that the old Australian government wasn't a Canada wannabe or that there are not huge problems in Eastern Europe and in the legacy Soviet countries and that there's not kakistocracies throughout Africa and Latin America. It's hardly like this is the only problem. But with respect to powerful, highly sophisticated, rich, highly technological countries that are unable to face the cold, simple facts of potentially catastrophic natural change, we seem to be in a class of our own.
Well, it seems like it's not only that we can't do anything about it, we can't even like have a serious discussion about it.
That's the strategy, isn't it? I mean, that's what they have successfully created an ideological and social context in which we cannot have a discussion about that. That is not an accident. That was the plan.
Okay. Well, you at EcoEquity have something of a slogan that justice, climate justice, is actually very practical. What do you mean by that?
Well, we believe that it is still physically possible to stabilize the climate. The odds are getting worse, not better, and you can make a case that it's too late, but we don't believe it's too late. We believe that we need to have a global emergency mobilization to stabilize the climate, and we believe that that mobilization will only occur if it is extremely fair. And by that I mean that the quote-unquote costs of the transition, this is not to say that there won't be massive benefits and massive opportunities associated with the transition, but there will also be costs, that the costs must be borne fairly, and that the transition, by and large, needs to lift up the poor and protect the vulnerable, that if it does not do so, it simply will not work politically. It will never build the momentum that it needs to build for the kind of transition we need to make to happen in an unprecedentedly short period of time. We believe that justice is literally a realist precondition for the stabilization of the climate, and that if we don't get a very, very fair global mobilization that people can believe in, we're going to get runaway climate change.
Well, I think a lot of Americans think, you know, that we don't want to have to pay for somebody else's cleanup. How can you persuade a bunch of provincial and rich and spoiled people otherwise?
You know, this is a very interesting sort of insider debate going on right now about the reparations debate and the carbon debt debate as opposed to the opportunity framing, and you know, there's a lot to say about it, and it is absolutely true that if you want to kill any kind of climate legislation, any kind of international climate legislation in the United States, all you have to do is start talking about writing checks to China. But the truth of the matter is that Americans want to do their fair share, and they want to do the right thing, and they don't enjoy images of suffering poor people around the world. And the problem is to find a way of constructing the American obligation, which is rooted in its wealth and its responsibility to be part of the solution, and to present that obligation to the American people, to ourselves, in a way that we can believe. It's a very, very difficult problem, because, as you know, this is a nationalist country, an isolationist country, and often a bit of a wacky country.
Yes. And self-pitying. All those people want our stuff.
Everybody wants our stuff. You know, it's such a hard situation, Doug, because there's just not, a technical term, enough environmental space on this planet for everybody to live the way we live. It's just not there. And, you know, it's not difficult to draw out and realize what the implications of that are. It means that either we're going to get a fairer world in which we all live a bit differently than we live today, or we're going to get a highly polarized, highly militarized, and highly unstable world. And the other storylines are petering out. You know, there aren't really that many paths forward from here.
Okay, we have to bring it to a close. Thanks for joining us, Tom Athanasiou. And I thought you were going to encourage me, but no.
You didn't give me time to be encouraged.
Okay, well, you'll have to come back and we'll do part two of the encouraging
closing
act.
There is a positive side to the story,
okay,
which is that if we did this thing, it would be fabulous.
Okay, all right. That'll have to do for now, but you'll be back to talk about it at greater length. Thanks. I've been speaking with Tom Athanasiou, who is the director of EcoEquity. You can find him on the web at ecoequity.org. And let's take a break, and then we'll be back to talk about that healthcare abomination.
Only two things scare me, and one is nuclear war.
What's the other?
Excuse me?
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to
WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York?
New York.
And this is WBAI in New York, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, do click that donate button, because we could always use your help. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about healthcare reform. That was all of the 11th of 12 pieces for piano in the grouping Notations by Pierre Boulez. That was performed by P. Shen Chen. And we are now joined by Steffi Wohlhandler, who is a co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program and also practices medicine in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome, Steffi.
My pleasure.
So that thing that just passed Congress and just got repassed because of some technical adjustments, and better than nothing?
Well, it's really a step sideways. It's not a step forward or a step back. It's a little bit like debating aspirin versus Tylenol for breast cancer. You know, the patient needs surgery, and the things have been adjusted and switched around, but nothing has been fixed.
Well, you'll hear a lot of liberals say when you say something like that, well, 30 million people are going to get health insurance, it will stabilize the private market and make people less likely to get kicked off or denied coverage. Is any of that true? Well, are there good things to it?
Okay. There's 32 million people who will be insured by 2019 if it works as expected, but there's going to be 23 million uninsured people in 2019. Many of the people are going to end up getting new insurance policies, but they will be so skimpy that they'll have insurance and still won't be able to afford care. So a family, you know, who's getting subsidies will be forced to pay up to 9.5% of their income in premiums, and that'll be for a policy that only pays 70% of their health care costs. So people
with large deductibles too, right?
Yeah, huge deductibles, co-payments. The Massachusetts law, on which the federal law is based, someone my age who has to pay more than $5,000 a year in premium, but then there's the deductible, so when you get sick, you have to take an additional $2,000 out of your pocket before the insurance even kicks in, and then you have to pay 20% of your health expenses after that. So, you know, for a middle-income person, that is a very high cost, and healthcare will still be unaffordable for many of these newly insured. Now, there will be 15 million people added to Medicaid, and if the American people want to tax themselves to pay for healthcare for the poor, and I think we should as middle-class people, we could have done that without the rest of this legislation.
I don't understand how the Congressional Budget Office, who is usually a pretty reliable source, says that we're going to expand coverage and subsidize coverage, and yet it's going to reduce health expenditures. How does that add up?
Well, it really doesn't. There's about $447 billion in taxpayer money that is going to be going to private health insurance to subsidize the purchase of private health insurance. So you might ask, you know, well, how can you give almost $500 billion to the insurance industry and have it budget neutral? Well, part of the way the Congressional Budget Office did its calculations is they calculated revenues for 10 years, beginning now, but the benefits of this bill don't even start until 2014, 4 years from now. So there's 10 years of revenue, only 6 years of expenses in that calculation.
I thought they said there are even more savings in the second 10 years, though.
I don't believe that's true. The Congressional Budget Office only does their calculations for 10 years by law. I think some people may have said they think there'll be more, but the official calculation by law can only go out to 2019.
Are they going to whack Medicare?
Well, they're saying they're going to save huge amounts of money from Medicare. Some of that money, perhaps the best aspect of the bill from my point of view, some of that money is going to come out of the Medicare HMOs, the Medicare Advantage programs, these private plans that have been getting overpaid by Medicare. So that I'm on board with. Let's not be overpaying private plans. Let's not be privatizing Medicare. But very worrisome is the fact that the Congressional Budget Office projects that $40 billion in Medicare funds will be taken away from safety net hospitals. So the remaining 22 million uninsured, the tens of millions who will have policies so skimpy that they are woefully underinsured, those people are still going to need to rely on safety net hospitals like Bellevue, like Harlem Hospital, like Cambridge City Hospital where I work. But those hospitals will see their Medicare funding cut by this bill.
Now, I had your partner David Himmelstein on here a few months ago, and he was talking about what happened to charity care in Massachusetts under your system, which is in many ways a kind of foretaste of what we're going to see nationally. What exactly happened with the charity care system there?
Well, when they put in place a bill almost identical to this in Massachusetts, I have to tell you that the insurance industry in the state was jubilant. Our bill was actually written by Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation. They put together the framework. The framework on this federal bill was put together in Senator Baucus's office by a staff person named Liz Fowler, who came directly from WellPoint, the nation's largest for-profit insurance company, where she was a vice president. So like the national bill, we had a bill in Massachusetts that was written by our insurance industry. And one of the things that was written into both bills was that, this bill is going to solve all our problems. We won't even need a safety net anymore. Let's take some money out of the safety net. And in Massachusetts, our hospital has seen its funding go down already. We've had to close half of our psychiatry beds, discharge half of our psychiatry outpatients, and we were the largest provider of indigent psychiatric care in this part of the state. So we're turning away patients, reducing our services, and safety net hospitals nationally will be expected to reduce their services under the myth that we'll have achieved universal access to private health insurance, universal access to private care. And, you know, the facts simply don't add up. There's going to be tens of millions of uninsured, tens of millions of underinsured people. There's still going to be a need for that safety net care.
A lot of the consumers of that kind of care are undocumented immigrants, and this bill in Congress, or the federal bill, quite consciously by design excluded undocumented immigrants from coverage. So are those folks really going to take a disproportionate hit through this reform?
Well, you know, I'm a doctor, and I think every sick person deserves care. I don't care what their documents say. If they're sick, they deserve care. And, you know, I think that's an ethical principle of being a doctor. I think it's an ethical principle of most religions. And the attack on immigrants implied in this bill is, in my mind, unconscionable.
I'm speaking with Steffi Wohlhandler, is one of the co-founders of Physicians for a National Health Program and a primary care physician at Cambridge City Hospital up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's amazing you talked about the insurance industry roots of this kind of legislation, but also I saw, I think, David Frum, conservative writer, said that a lot of it can be traced back to some work the Heritage Foundation did to respond to Clinton's original health care proposals. So it's remarkable that we have this thing that comes out of Heritage and the insurance industry, yet is portrayed as socialist by the Republican Party.
Yes, well, I mean, the bill is philosophically Republican. The whole idea of mandate models where the government uses its coercive power to force private people, private parties to hand over money to private health insurance, that's the so-called mandate model, was invented by Richard Nixon in 1972 as a response to single-payer legislation being introduced by then-Senator Edward Kennedy. So it was a Republican idea. This model of this legislation was first enacted by a Republican governor in Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, in 2006. The whole idea of taxing health benefits that's in this bill was put forward by Republican presidential candidate John McCain. This is philosophically a Republican bill, and yet the Republicans have vociferously attacked the bill, and I think the only way we can understand that is as a political theater to try to portray Barack Obama is callow and weak and ineffective. So, you know, there's this crazy political theater going on where Obama has moved this bill and this process very far to the right and yet has not attracted a single Republican senator and has got the Republicans party, Republicans playing this game about how terrible the bill is. And it's, you know, particularly contradictory for folks like Mitt Romney, who signed this bill in Massachusetts in 2006, Scott Brown, our new senator who took Senator Kennedy's old seat, Scott Brown voted for this bill in Massachusetts. So a Republican bill, but now they're all playing this theater to try to, you know, maintain this fiction that Obama is incompetent. And it's just a fiction, but they're willing to play that game.
How does the funding for poorer residents in Massachusetts work out? I mean, there are some subsidies offered very similar to the federal bill?
Yes. The subsidies are virtually identical to the federal bill. What has happened is people, very poor people who get completely free care, people under 150% of poverty, they don't have to pay anything. They're completely subsidized. Those people have enrolled in large numbers in the insurance. But the folks who have to pay half of the bill or three-quarters of the bill themselves are really not enrolling because it's still extremely expensive. You have to understand as well, though, that this system in Massachusetts was very heavily subsidized by the taxpayers in the other 49 states. So half of the cost of the reform in Massachusetts was picked up by the federal government, that is, taxpayers in the other 49 states. When you take that same reform national, that funding trick doesn't work anymore.
Well, is that because of Medicaid?
Yes. The Medicaid matching funds were made available for all aspects of the reform in Massachusetts, so the subsidized care as well.
Now, what about the regulation of insurance companies in this bill? There's a lot of talk about how they won't be able to deny you coverage because of pre-existing conditions. They won't be able to drop you if you get sick. Is there any truth to these claims?
Well, those kinds of words are in the bill, but the bill has been written by the insurance industry, and it's full of loopholes. So once you get sick, they're not allowed to drop you unless they say it's fraud. That is the law already. That's contract law. You can't sign a contract with me and then revoke the contract unless you say it's fraud. And that's exactly what they've been doing already to do these so-called rescissions. So it looks great to say they can't drop you unless it's fraud, but that's the rule already. Similarly, they have to take you, but they can charge an older person three times as much as they can charge a younger person. They can design their benefits so that people with expensive illnesses don't want to enroll. One insurance company in Texas, for instance, refuses to contract with the lung specialist for cystic fibrosis. If you have a child with cystic fibrosis, they need to see a cystic fibrosis expert. But if Aetna refuses to sign a contract with that expert, you're going to have to take your child elsewhere, get insurance elsewhere. So there's hundreds of tricks that the insurance industry will use to try to get rid of expensive sick people and recruit the healthy. And, you know, there are some regulations in this bill, some regulations better than no regulation, but it is full of loopholes. And I want to give just one more example of these loopholes, and one that's very easy for people to understand. There was some publicity about part of this bill is going to require McDonald's and other fast food companies to post their calorie counts. That's a great idea. Only they wrote in the loophole that you don't have to post a calorie count for anything that's on the menu for less than 60 days. So, you know, we're going to see the new triple bacon burger available for limited time only, no calorie counts. That's a silly example, but the entire bill is written by industry with those kind of loopholes written in at every step of the process.
So what mechanisms for regulation are written to the bill, or has that not been settled upon yet?
Well, I haven't read all several thousand pages of the bill. In fact, it hasn't actually been available for reading. I do know that the Senate bill did have some, good regulations. At least there's a structure for starting to look at the difference in premiums charged to different people. In the individual market, it's going to be very helpful. 7% of Americans, it's a minority, but 7%, do have to buy their insurance in the individual market. They have to go out and buy it themselves. And this is likely to be very helpful for that 7% of Americans, and I'm very glad they're getting some help. They need it.
Now, and what about employer-based insurance? Are there any incentives for employers to expand or to drop coverage in this legislation?
It's written to try to maintain the status quo instead of in terms of large employers. If you now get your insurance through your large employer, you're unlikely to see any change in the short run, other than the fact that if you have insurance through your employer and don't like it, you have to keep it. The new individual mandate says you have to take the insurance from your employer. Over the long run, there will be a new excise tax on employer-paid health benefits. That's another Republican idea. Senator John McCain ran on it during the last presidential election. Obama opposed it. But Obama has picked up this Republican idea and put it into this bill. And many people in high-cost states, like New York, like Massachusetts, will fall into the range where you have to pay the excise tax. And the excise tax is high. It's 40%, regardless of your income. So this is an expensive new tax likely to fall on unionized workers in high-cost states like New York and Massachusetts.
And they're also indexed the tax bracket to, was it 1 point less the inflation rate? So it's designed to bite more and more people over time.
Yes, it's indexed to 1% below inflation, and if healthcare costs rise as they are projected to do, many people in your state and my state will be paying this excise tax when it goes into effect in 2018.
And what about the issue of cost control? Is there anything that really is going to put the lid on medical inflation that we can see here?
There's nothing in the bill that will put the lid on medical inflation. Just looking at the experience here in Massachusetts, in 2006 when we enacted this reform, we had the highest health care costs of any state, which is also another way of saying we had the highest health care costs of any location anywhere in the history of the world here in Massachusetts. Since 2006, our health care costs have not only risen, they've risen more rapidly than costs in the other 49 states. So the test drive of this reform suggests that healthcare costs will go up very rapidly. And there's many nice things in the bill that we hope may help at some future date. Cost-effectiveness research, I think, is a nice idea. But that has never been proven to reduce health costs in and of itself. So I think we have to say, based on the Massachusetts experience, that the cost will be exploding with this bill, and there's going to be continued pressure on the health benefits of middle-class people, the health benefits of people on Medicare, to pay for this extremely expensive bill. And, of course, the reason I think it's so expensive is the inclusion of the private health insurance industry with their extremely high administrative costs, overhead, and waste.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. Like you force 30 million people to buy insurance from this incredibly greedy and corrupt and criminal industry. It seems like a recipe to make costs rise even more rapidly, not less so.
Well, I do think that's true. You know, the average insurance company in the United States has overhead of about 13 to 14%. A Canadian National Health Insurance has overhead of less than 1%. But in addition to the 14 or 15% that the private insurance companies charge for their own overhead, they foist huge administrative burdens onto doctors and hospitals, such that total administrative costs in the U.S. healthcare system are about 31% of spending, about twice as much as in Canada. And by going to a single-payer system, a Medicare for All system, which is what I advocate, we could simplify administration, save about $400 billion annually, and then we'd be able to afford to cover all of the uninsured, to plug the gaps in coverage for people who now have partial coverage, which is probably most of us and most people listening to this broadcast.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I read this fact, and I think I should have known this, but I was surprised to read a fact sheet on your website, pnhp.org, that business pays less than 20% of our nation's health bill. It is a misnomer that our health system is privately financed. 60% is paid by taxes, and the remaining 20% is out-of-pocket payments that people make. So this people are already paying through the nose for this thing, either through taxes or their own personal expenditures, and getting a rather poor return on their investment.
Absolutely. The absolute dollar amount that Americans pay in taxes to purchase health care, to provide health care, actually exceeds the total cost of the national health program on a per capita basis in Canada. So we're already paying through taxes the full cost of universal coverage. We're taking thousands of dollars more out of our pockets to pay privately. You know, and we still have currently 47 million uninsured. With this bill enacted, we'll have 23 million uninsured and tens of millions more with, you know, woefully underinsured.
And what kind of coverage does Medicaid offer people?
Well, the best thing I can say about Medicaid is it's a whole lot better than no insurance, okay, which is often the other option for very low-income people. So Medicaid is much better than being uninsured. But the problems with Medicaid is the reimbursement is often so low that you can't get in to see a doctor, you can't get into certain hospitals and specialists, and that's really not fair. I mean, I think every sick person deserves care, and giving people a card that means they can't go to certain hospitals, can't get certain types of care is not fair, and, you know, it's not good public health policy. The distribution of health care has to be based on need. It can't be based on giving all sorts of excessive care to people with good insurance and lots of money, giving them care they don't even need, that's useless or even harmful to them just because they can pay for it, and then depriving low-income people of care that they need because they're poor. That's not the way to design a good healthcare system. It's not good for the poor, and it's not good for the wealthy.
We've only got a minute or two left, but I'm just curious, what does the passage of this bill do for the fight for single payer? Does it make it easier, more difficult, no change?
Well, certainly the need for national health insurance, single payer, is still there. All of the same problems are there, problems in access and problems in cost. And our group of 17,000 physicians and physicians for national health programs thinks we still need to be fighting for single-payer national health insurance. I think we're going to find a little bit of a dip in the discussion and the movement for a few years, as people kind of wait to see if maybe things will get better. I think very quickly it's going to be clear that this is not a solution and the single-payer movement will rise up again.
And what about the prospects for doing it at the state level? Does this leave enough of an opening for states to do it?
Well, the openings in the bill are not very dramatic, but we've always seen it in our organization, several of our state chapters do work on a state level. Most of the group works on a national level, but we have supported state chapters trying to do demonstration projects at a state level. I know there's movement in Vermont, for instance, to do that. So we support that idea of single state demonstration projects, but we do think ultimately that it would have to be a national single-payer Medicare for All system.
All right, thank you very much. I've been
talking
with Steffi Wohlhandler, who is one of the co-founders of Physicians for a National Health Program, which you can find on the web at pnhp.org, a rich set of resources on this topic. And she's also a primary care physician at Cambridge City Hospital. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this classic from Reckless Eric. Till next week. Bye.